from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
It's alive! It's alive! It's alive!
Mary Shelley's gothic thriller Frankenstein turns 200 this year, and over the centuries, her novel and the scientist and the creature he created have taken on lives of their own. Frankenstein has inspired countless films, TV shows, and works of fiction, and its themes inform contemporary debates about bioethics and the relationship between technology and society. We'll explore the novel's legacy next, after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. I bid my hideous progeny go forth and prosper. So wrote Mary Shelley in her introduction to the 1831 edition of Frankenstein, the novel she began composing at age 18 after Lord Byron challenged her to write a ghost story. Cited alternatively as creation myth, bioethical cautionary tale, and psychological study, Frankenstein turns 200 this year, and in this hour of Forum, we'll explore the novel's legacy in literature, film, and science. Let me tell you who's joining us for the hour here in studio. I want to welcome Ellen Peel, full disclosure, a colleague of mine for many years at San Francisco State, former professor in the Department of English and Comparative and World Literature there. And welcome, Ellen.
I'm happy to be here.
Glad to have you. We also have Lester Friedman with us this morning. He's Emeritus Professor of Media and Society at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. His books include Monstrous Progeny, A History of the Frankenstein Narratives. Good to have you with us, Lester Friedman.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. And we'll also welcome Sam Arbisman, who is scientist in residence at Lux Capital. They're a venture capital firm. His books include Overcomplicated Technology at the Limits of Comprehension. And welcome, Sam Arbisman.
Great to be with you.
Good to have you. Let me begin with Professor Ellen Peel. And Ellen, this is, some say, the first book of science fiction. This is a book, as you've pointed out, about both popular and academic, about a character with no name mainly, but there are so many ways that we can talk about it. Let's begin with what I was trying to highlight a bit in the introduction, and that was how this was all conceived. Short stories on a stormy night in Lake Geneva, basically.
Yes, so it was a very rainy night because it was the year when a volcanic explosion had caused the atmosphere to be dark, and there was a lot of rain that year. So they... Mary Shelley, Percy Shelley, her husband, Lord Byron, and Byron's doctor were sitting around in Geneva reading ghost stories, and Byron proposed, let's have a contest. And everybody tried. Mary, I'll call her Mary to keep clear who's who. Mary tried in vain. She also said that the illustrious poets, Byron and Percy, abandoned their prosaic task. So, in other words, they blew it off. But she kept trying, couldn't think of anything, went to bed, was in a kind of waking dream, and envisioned the pale student of unhallowed arts.
Waking dream or a nightmare?
Well, exactly. And she pictured the scientist waking up and seeing his creature standing over him, and at that moment, she herself opened her eyes in her bed. So that was one of the moments where her creation was like the scientist's creation. And she eventually wrote it up and published it.
18-year-old woman, as we said.
It's incredible, yeah.
And the actual composition, I just want to read this, of the first 72,000-word draft lasted some 11 months until May of 1817, during which her stepsister, Claire, bore Byron's illegitimate baby secretly in Bath. Her half-sister, Fanny Imlay, committed suicide with an opium overdose in a Welsh hotel. And Percy Shelley's legal but abandoned wife, Harriet Shelley, quote, being far advanced in pregnancy, that's according to the Times, committed suicide by throwing herself into the Serpentine. So much background biography to this, I mean, in terms of just crises in her life. And she also found out that she was pregnant.
Yes, and she, over the course of her life, only one of the four children to whom she gave birth survived to adulthood, plus she had various miscarriages, plus her own birth had caused the death of her mother, Mary Wollstonecraft, of an infection 10 days after Mary Godwin Shelley was born. So.
And the manuscript was delivered, we should add, to the publisher about 5 weeks before her baby was born. But let's talk about the novel with you. Again, Professor Ellen Peel with us here in studio. You know, it's such a multifaceted novel with so many ways to approach it and so many themes. In fact, it's kind of a Rorschach for readers, isn't it?
Definitely, yes. And it's hard to even know whom to sympathize with this overreaching scientist who, I mean, everybody agrees that things go badly, but whose fault is it? Was he imitating God and that was admirable? Was he challenging God and getting punished? What about the creature, the poor abandoned son? On the other hand, the creature is a murderer. So as you were saying in the intro, there are psychological ways to look at it, bioethical, political, philosophical.
Well, there is also a lot of film work that's been done, and I thought let's just hear, if we could, and then we'll talk with Lester Friedman, who has done a lot of work on this. This is perhaps the most famous scene in the original 1931 film Frankenstein, in which Dr. Frankenstein, is played by Colin Clive, announces his creation.
It's alive! It's alive! It's alive! It's alive! It's alive!
Oh, in the name of God, now I know what it feels like to be God. And Professor Friedman, one of the most fascinating things about that, they took that in the name of God, now I know what it feels like to be God, out of the film and censored it.
Right, they did. They thought that was really a little too blasphemous. And indeed, the novel is different from the film in substantive ways, I think, or I should say the film is different from the novel in many ways. But Ellen's right. It's hard to figure who to be sympathetic to. And most interestingly, of course, they rob the creature, who is very literate and self-taught in the novel. Karloff robs him of a voice. So we have a mute creature. We have essentially a person with a disability in many ways. We would think about it in modern terms, I think.
Now, you teach the Frankenstein story as a story of an abandoned child and neglected by a responsible parent, but also in conjunction with the other. I mean, you know, there's a lot of literary interpretation. Caliban comes quickly to mind about the other.
Right.
But, you know, some thinking about disabled or gay or, you know, those who are outsiders, marginal.
Well, I think that that's true. Joe Dante, who is a fairly famous horror film director, once said, "Show me a monster, I'll show you a metaphor." And I think that's pretty true, that almost all creatures in some way represent our darkest thoughts and our fears and our anxieties, both as a culture and of the individual creator. But Frankenstein's creature, and when I teach him, I would never call him a monster. I would use the word creature. Frankenstein's creature in particular has been absolutely interpreted in a vast variety of ways, from representing the French Revolution to representing Donald Trump. I was just looking at some cartoons in which Trump is the creature. Never the doctor, the creature.
Yeah, well, you've also written about how the films of Frankenstein, and let me just, before I go to the question I want to ask you about the films about Frankenstein, the titles are so revealing.
Right.
I mean, and funny. I mean, Bride of Frankenstein, of course, we know Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. I mean, I Was a Teenage Frankenstein. You go through the whole list of them, and one of my favorites, Frankenstein's College Years, they're...
You forgot Frankenhooker.
Frankenhooker, right? I mean, there's just so much there that tells us about just how this story has captured, well, not only the moral imagination, but really the cultural imagination for, these 200 years.
Well, I think that's true. And the more, as we've gotten more technologically oriented and technologically anxious, I would argue, the story really has more and more relevance. One of the interesting things is the evolution of the central characters. Dr. Frankenstein, by the way, he's not a doctor. He's really a failed medical student more than anything else, and the creature. So the Dr. Frankenstein, I'll just use that term, has become increasingly crazy, but also the first image of Frankenstein that we see and the current ones are relatively the same. they are someone who challenges the laws of God and nature, whatever they might be. But the creature has changed and in many ways has become a different iteration for each social kind of era. So, for example, in our own era, the creature has become far, as Ellen says, far more sympathetic, but also in a movie like I, Frankenstein, or in some of the later movies, has actually become the defendant of mankind, the protector of mankind, has become essentially a hero. And I think that that's a really interesting evolution. And also the creature, the whole narrative changes when the creature or the creation is female, as you might imagine.
Yeah, I was also struck by when we heard that clip from the 1931 film, how they had people dressed as doctors and nurses. They paid them to do this, telling those who came in to get a ticket that they would be scared and there were ambulances at the ready. I mean, it's fascinating history, and it's history that we can be amused by, but there are deeper meanings, and that's one of the things that I'm really concerned about exploring with in this hour we have. Again, we're talking about Frankenstein, 200 years later, the creature and its creator, with Ellen Peel, who's here with us in studio, former professor in the departments of English and Comparative Literature and World Literature at San Francisco State University, Lester Friedman, who is emeritus professor of media and society at Herbst and William Smith Colleges. His books include Monstrous Progeny, A History of the Frankenstein Narratives. And Sam Arbusman is also with us. He's scientist in residence at Lux Capital, a venture capital firm. And he's the author of a number of books, including Overcomplicated Technology at the Limits of Comprehension. And we do, with the Frankenstein story, Sam Arbusman, get right into technology, not only complex technology and so much that is on our, well, everyday platter these days in terms of the news, but also in mm-hmm. terms of the future, even single technologies. But let's talk first with you about just how this ties in with hubris and the scientist, and maybe even the mad scientist.
Yeah, I think whenever you are trying to understand a complex technology, people try to kind of think of it in terms of engineered systems and saying, okay, and we think of ourselves as fairly logical and rational creatures, therefore we should be building things that are logical and easy to understand. But often and many times, they're not. These are incredibly complex systems with lots of interacting parts, lots of feedback, and many unintended and kind of unexpected consequences. And when we think that we're going to build a system that's easily understood and it's not, there's often this kind of there's a disconnect. And in this gap, we often get this hubris in the face of systems we don't truly understand. And that can often cause a great deal of problems when it's revealed, when technology becomes buggy or there's some other sort of glitch or some sort of big failure where the difference between how we thought the system was going to actually operate and how it actually does.
Well, there are a lot of analogies that certainly have come forward with Frankenstein, most prominently perhaps artificial intelligence and machines and humans crossing over borders, robotics and so forth. But I've seen, and I just want to get your comment on this, Sam Arbusman. I mean, I've seen analogies and discussions of ethical dilemmas that are appropriate or inappropriate, use of stem cells and organ donation and organ harvesting and animal and human transplants. I mean, the list just goes on and on Frankenstein being an analog, really.
Yeah, I think it's often used as this kind of touchstone. But I think we also need to recognize that when we think about understanding a complex system, it's not there's not just kind of two poles and that's it. It's not either total ignorance or complete understanding. There is a spectrum of actually understanding maybe individual parts or how things are put together. And I think ultimately when we approach a new technology or a new biotechnology or whatever it is, we have to be approaching it with a sense of humility and not in the sense that we'll never understand everything, but in the sense that there are it's certainly possible that there might be pieces we can never truly understand. And therefore, we have to be humble in our approach with technology, which is kind of strange when you say, okay, we have to be humble with the things we ourselves have built. But I think increasingly we need to apply that to our computational technologies like artificial intelligence. We have to apply it to our biotechnologies and really anything that we ourselves have built. We need this humility as opposed to unnecessary hubris, which will often cause us to misunderstand the system that we have built.
And which many have pointed out is more likely to come from working alone as opposed to working with others and feeling more humble about being in a team or whatever. What about a couple of analogies, though, that have that you've brought to the fore here, like self-driving cars or biohacking, which I think some see as the height of hubris, perhaps.
Yeah, I think especially with biohacking, the idea of that if you ingest a certain chemical or a pill or do some sort of new technique, then suddenly everything is going to be better. You're going to be healthier or wiser or some, or you're going to be kind of overclocking your body in some sort of way. And I think a lot of that sort of approach comes from people coming from the engineering mindset, saying, okay, we can really understand how our bodies are engineered and make them better, as opposed to saying, recognizing that that to a certain degree is a category error. I mean, our human bodies, I mean, they've evolved over millions of years. They've been optimized in ways we probably don't fully understand. These are enormously complex systems with feedback, and to therefore say we're going to sweep away all of that complexity and just try to change something in one very simple way misunderstands all of that complexity. I think rather than recognizing that, wait a second, there's edge cases, there's kind of exceptions, there's complexities, and slowly but surely understanding the human body or any sort of biological system, I think that's kind of a much better sort of approach. And you mentioned also with self-driving cars. And it's one, and it's not a trivial matter to build a car that goes on a highway with no other traffic and a nice sunny day, but it's certainly a lot easier than doing that in sort of the complexity of the real world with one-way streets and pedestrians and animals darting out, or even just other cars being driven by highly irrational people. And suddenly, these things are much, much more complex, and we have to recognize and actually grapple with the full complexity of the world around us.
And let Michael, me go back, if I may. I'm sorry, Les Friedman, you wanted in here? Go ahead.
Well, I was going to just interject something here, and I think there are two ethical questions, and we're talking about the result of scientific exploration, technological advancement, but I think there are two questions that sort of precede that, and that the first question, and they both come from Frankenstein, by the way, the first question is, if we can do something, does that mean that we should do something? That's the first question. Are there limits on scientific exploration? These are very large questions, of course. And the second one is, what is the responsibility of the creator for what he or she creates? So, for example, is Oppenheimer responsible for Hiroshima? Those kinds of questions seem to me to be at the heart of technology. I don't know if anybody read the article in the Times this weekend. Elon Musk and Zuckerberg met, and they had an argument about AI. Musk was very, very anxious about it and negative about it. And Zuckerberg,
excuse me, Musk has said it's more dangerous to us than the Islamic State or anything on the earth.
That's right. Yeah. That's an amazing statement from him. And Zuckerberg, of course, argued, apparently, I wasn't at the dinner, but apparently argued.
Well, you weren't invited either. Both of us weren't invited.
No, it's very depressing to miss these.
Well, actually, Lester Friedman, I'd like you to comment on, since we're in this vein of discussion here, on a scene from Steven Spielberg's 2001 film AI, which many people probably remember. It was in which Gigolo Joe, the robot played by Jude Law, explains the relationship between the robots and the humans that created them.
They made us too smart, too quick, and too many. We are suffering for the mistakes they made because when the end comes, all that will be left is us. That's why they hate us.
Les Friedman, thoughts from you?
It's great. It's great dialogue. And I was talking earlier about the evolution of the creature. And this is one interesting evolution because in Frankenstein, both the early films, excuse me, and the novel, one of the reasons that the creature is ostracized is because he's ugly. They scream and hate him immediately just because of the way he looks. Well, as the films develop, the creatures get beautiful, strong, intelligent. And another film I would recommend to people in this vein would be Ex Machina, which picks up this same theme. And guess what? The humans still hate them. And Gigolo Joe. So it has nothing to do with how they look. It has nothing to do with anything, just the notion of difference. Orga versus Mega, as there is in that, novel and that film. So Joe's right. You create basically something better than you are, and then you fear it because exactly what Musk is talking about. that it will take over for you. I mean, this goes all the way back to Hal and, of course, to in 2001.
Yeah.
And, of course, goes all the way back to Frankenstein as well. I mean, what's the central Frankenstein narrative? I created you, you've run amok, and now you're going to kill me. That's the Frankenstein narrative in three acts.
Frankenstein is 200, and we'd like to know your thoughts about Frankenstein, the book, the films, or the myth, and what does it mean to you? And certainly would welcome reflections and thoughts along those lines. So let me invite you to join us now at our toll-free number. The number to call is 866-733-6786. We welcome your involvement and join the conversation, please, at 866-733-6786. Other ways you can join us, email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. We welcome your involvement, thoughts about Frankenstein, the book, the movie, what it means to you, and what the story, particularly in your judgment, ties in with some of the things we're talking about here in terms of motifs. And let me go back to Ellen Peel as we come up on the break here. Because, Ellen, there's so much, as we said earlier, that we can do in approaching Frankenstein, the novel or the films. Just the myth itself. It's a gothic melodrama. It's a satire. It's a moral parable. It's a love story, an adventure story, and so the list goes on. I know you've pretty much, despite all these themes or notwithstanding them, you have this notion of a Franken-genre. Dracula fits in here. Pygmalion fits in here. But the idea is the construction of a body. Yeah.
Yeah, so I see Frankenstein as the locus classicus for Franken-genre. But as you say, mentioning Pygmalion, their predecessors, or in Shakespeare's Winter's Tale, here's a spoiler, it looks like a statue coming to life. It's actually a person. But it really got going with Frankenstein, probably the first work of science fiction. And I think people haven't recognized how related all these different stories are: robots, cyborgs, people with eating disorders, vampire thralls. I think that you can look at bodies constructed from scratch, or bodies that are enhanced, like with an organ transplant, or mentally constructed bodies, like an M. Butterfly, when you look at a man and think it's a woman, or in E.T.A. Hoffman's story, The Sandman. I think they all have a common aesthetic. They bring up this issue of perfection that Les was hinting at. What is success when you build one of these bodies? Is it it's just like a human body, or is it better than a human body? Either way, you're in trouble.
And in the early part of the 19th century, both in the United States and in the United Kingdom, Frankenstein was really thought to be what's going to happen monstrously if you free the slaves. I mean, it became identified with the abolition movement in terms of criticizing and condemning the abolition movement. There's just so many facets to this Frankenstein story. We're scratching the surface here, but we do want to hear your thoughts, and feel free to join us. Again, you can do that by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going right to our website, kqed.org/forum. Ellen Peel is with us, Lester Friedman is with us, and Sam Arbisman is with us. You could be with us, too. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about Frankenstein, the creature and its creator. I have hearing in recesses of memory a bunch of high school kids yelling out, "Igor, Igor," because we had a gym teacher named Kilgore. And Igor did not even appear in the original Frankenstein. But we're talking about not only the original Frankenstein and the novel, but the many films. Here's Janis, who writes, "The Frankenstein version by Branagh, starring him, De Niro, and Helena Bonham Carter, is one of the greatest films ever. The visuals are striking, the acting outstanding, particularly the scene where De Niro tracks down Branagh in the ice and has a conversation about him not fulfilling his responsibility. Too many beautiful, well-acted scenes to recount here." We're going to hear probably from more listeners in terms of what they love or remember about Frankenstein stories or films, or what they think about the myth and its relevance, particularly to today's technology and science, which we also touched on. Here, by the way, is an excerpt from a song, I Can Make You Man. It's just sung by Tim Curry, who plays Dr. Frankenfurter in the original Rocky Horror Picture Show. And Dr. Frankenfurter is a mad scientist who tries to create his own sexual partner.
You be a strong man. Oh, honey, but the wrong man. He'll eat nutritious, high protein, and swallow raw eggs. Try to build up his shoulders, his chest, arms, and legs. Such an effort. If he only knew of my plan, in just 7 days, I can make you a man. He'll do press-ups.
Well, that touches on what Les Friedman, who's one of our panelists this morning, was talking about with respect to the evolution of Frankenstein in movies. And by the way, Frankenstein actually started and got more popular because of theater and opera. That was when it came to greater public attention. Let me tell you again who is with us. We're talking with Lester Friedman, Emeritus Professor of Media and Society at Hobart and William Smith Colleges and author of Monstrous Progeny, A History of the Frankenstein Narratives, and Sam Arbisman, who is scientist in residence at Lux Capital, a venture capital firm. He's the author of Overcomplicated, Technology at the Limits of Comprehension. And also with us in studio is Ellen Peel, former professor in the departments of English and Comparative Lit, Comparative and World Lit at San Francisco State University. Let me bring another voice into this, and that's Audrey Schaefer, who is director of Medicine in the Muse, a program at Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics. She's also professor of anesthesiology, perioperative and pain medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine, and the Veterans Affairs Palo Alto Healthcare System. And welcome, Dr. Schaefer. Good to have you.
Thanks so much.
Let's start off by talking about some of the I guess the best way to phrase this is the activities are going on around Frankenstein. There's an exhibit at the Cantor Arts Center, and there's all kinds of discussions, lectures, and so forth. This is Stanford's kind of hosting a lot of this.
Absolutely. We have an initiative that's campus-wide called Frankenstein at 200 that we've been planning for several years that includes people from many different schools and departments, as well as the community around Stanford. You mentioned the art museum exhibit. That is at Cantor Arts Center. It's called Betray the Secret, Humanity in the Age of Frankenstein. And it's ongoing till August 5th, open to the public. And I encourage people to visit, take a look at four different themes related to Frankenstein, including an amazing print by Hogarth to anatomy and a photograph by Diane Arbus. So there's just all kinds of angles. And I think through that exhibit, one can get a handle on the true interdisciplinarity of this topic and why it's so generative. There's a student exhibit at the medical school, including a look at the mapping of the human body in terms of dermatomes and other systems that's done by medical student Nick Love. And that is also open to the public and at the Lee Cushing Center, which is the medical school at Stanford. I have been so impressed by how imaginative, collaborative, and cooperative people have become when you mention Frankenstein and they relate it to their own experiences, their own perspective, and as you've mentioned, how important those perspectives are in this moment in biotechnological advancement.
Well, what does this mean to you personally, if I could ask, and professionally as a practicing physician and as an anesthesiologist? How does Frankenstein tie in with your vision of the work you do?
I feel that it ties in every day. As an anesthesiologist, I take great responsibility for an individual's life. That individual enters an altered state. They no longer can fend for themselves. And I think that the novel Frankenstein provides a counterpoint in terms of responsibility. Here, as physicians or any healthcare worker, we are taking care of people at an incredibly vulnerable point in their lives. And perhaps as anesthesiologists, we see that to the nth degree. There are also very specific areas in anesthesiology, such as providing anesthesia care for patients who are undergoing cardioversion and this use of electricity. Although in the novel, it's sort of referred to as galvanism. In the films, and I'm sure Les can attest to this, there's a lot of electricity going on, and it's to be witness to that, to be part of that, to care for somebody as they go through that, I think, is a remarkable responsibility, and I'm always amazed at that gift of trust that patients give me.
Again, let me thank you for joining us, Audrey Schaefer, Director of Medicine in the MUSE program at Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics and also Professor of Anesthesiology, Perioperative and Pain Medicine at Stanford School of Medicine. And we're going to go to your calls and emails here. Right before I do that, though, I'd like to bring back Sam Arbesman for just a moment. And Sam Arbesman, I'd like your response to these MIT scientists. Listeners may not remember this, but certainly it's pretty clear in my memory, putting together this character named Norman after Hitchcock's protagonist in Psycho, with all of these horrible kinds of images and statements from Reddit. And they created a psychopath. I mean, in terms of artificial intelligence, we have to factor that into maybe dystopian visions of the future, or apocalyptic visions like Elon Musk has. What's your response to that?
Well, I think in this case, it sounds like they were intentionally trying to pour a whole bunch of like really horrific comments and things from Reddit in order to kind of train this AI system and see how it would respond to identifying images. But I think more and more there's the situation of making sure that people are very intentional about the data that all these systems are being trained on. Because too often, especially when an AI is kind of being created kind of in isolation, the creators often think they're providing an unbiased data and really useful data, but it's not always that way. And so there was a situation a number of years ago where Microsoft created a chatbot called Tay. It was designed to I think mimic a teenage girl in chatting, and then I think within a day ended up acting like a white supremacist because it was just being – it was interacting with basically all the horrible people on the internet and being taught horrible things. And they had to shut it down. But there was another situation where IBM Watson wanted to they wanted to train IBM Watson to answer Jeopardy questions in understanding kind of more colloquial terms. And so they poured in the Urban Dictionary, the online website that kind of teaches you slang and things like that. And I guess fairly quickly it started cursing in all of its answers. And they had to eventually take that out. And so there's often just kind of making sure that the inputs are the actual desired inputs, because if you don't have the right input, you're not going to have the desired outputs. And you can still have – even with good input, you can still have really bad output. But it makes it a lot more difficult if you have really bad input. And so I think people need to be very intentional about the kinds of information that are being – these systems are being trained on, and also just making sure that these kinds of things and just don't happen. And similar to – we were talking about kind of the creature as this sort of abandoned child. Children are raised, and we teach them certain things. We really want to kind of inculcate them proper behaviors and proper information. And I think the same thing is increasingly true with our artificial technologies as well.
Well, inputs and outputs notwithstanding, I can't help thinking about, at this point, just genies out of bottles. I don't know how far those genies are out of the bottles, but let's go to our callers and let's find out what's on their minds and what they have to say. And we begin, Dan, with you. You're on the air.
Good day. In high school, we all read Frankenstein, and I hated it. I hated it. And now I love it. And for all the reasons that this show has discussed so far, for me it was the kickoff to the Romantic movement. And in high school, I wanted to study science. I believed in rationalism, and there are limits to the rational mind. And that's what's so great about the story Frankenstein and all of the various derivations and adaptations of it. So great show. Thank you very much.
And thank you. And I'm glad your taste matured. I appreciate that call. And let's get another caller on here. That's Joshua. Joshua, join us.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to call in as a high school teacher who, for the last couple of years, has taught this novel. I never read it until maybe, I don't know, in college or something, and just was blown away at it. But I wanted to remind one of the speakers, I'm sorry, it's kind of tuned in late and then tuned out while you guys were discussing as I got some chores, but the gentleman summarized the novel in three acts, saying basically to summarize him that a creator creates the creation, then in act two threatens the creator, and then in act three, I forget what that summary was, but I think there's a critical fourth act, that is that the creator has to dedicate himself, or at least feels compelled to dedicate himself to the sort of destruction of what he created. And I think that like offers a really bleak comment on the essential problem that AI poses, and sort of the bleaker, as the previous caller mentioned, the sort of romantic feeling that science is to some degree poses incredible threats to our existence. I just, just wanted to offer that as a kind of comment, as a maybe additional fourth act.
No, I thank you for that comment. And let me go to Ellen Pill on that fourth act question. Ellen?
I agree with that, I think Victor was only thinking as far as bringing his creature to life. He didn't anticipate there were going to be any other acts in his drama. And then he had to scramble around trying to undo what he had done. And he was very unsuccessful at that. I think he both was too active and in ways that antagonized the creature and made the creature even angrier and more murderous. He also was too inactive. He didn't give the creature a name. He didn't intentionally give him an education and so on. And I think that part of the problem is with a lot of these Franken-genre stories is the creator thinks of himself, it's often a he, as subject and the creation as object, and is totally surprised when the object takes on subjectivity, as when Frankenstein's creature opens his eyes and looks back, gazes at the creature with yellow, watery, but speculative eyes. So it's that failure to anticipate the subjectivity of the creation that's causes many of these fourth act problems.
I want to read some listener comments here. Eric says, comics are richer than TV or films, especially on themes of the doctor and monster is one, the self is other, trauma and mental health, nuclear age, etc. Eric says, for me, Vertigo is one of the most fascinating films to explore themes of Frankenstein, an obsessed man trying to transform a woman into his vision of perfection, who, of course, actually is that woman. Ed tweets, don't forget about Frankenweenie. It was a Tim Burton film back in 2012. And Chloe writes, we saw a ballet version of Frankenstein by choreographer Liam Scarlett. It was quite shocking for me. And Ben wants to know, and let me go to you on this, Les Friedman, favorite version of modern Frankenstein? His, he says, is Herman Munster, because he had to deal with modernity while still being a monster.
By the way, I think just to, I'll answer that in one second, but just to spin off what Ellen said, the thing we haven't talked about is that Frankenstein does learn something, because he will not create the bride for the creature. In the novel, at least, he thinks about what the alternatives are if you create two creatures, and will they procreate and create a super race. So he does learn something.
He's kind of changing the prelapsarian myth a bit, isn't he, of Adam and Eve?
Oh, he is. He is. Well, this has a lot to do with that myth, because Mary Shelley's great model here, other than the Bible, is John Milton. It's Paradise Lost. And there's many, many quotes in the novel, as Ellen knows.
Could we pause there for a moment? Because there are also many quotes. I just want to be a little intertextual for a moment, not only from Paradise Lost, but from Wordsworth's Tintern Abbey and from
a lot.
Coleridge's Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner. I mean,
and Percy Shelley. Yeah.
And Shelley, too.
Yeah. And Percy Shelley, right. And Percy Shelley goes off to write a Prometheus poem, or yeah. Film, whatever that might be. I guess that's a combination of film and poem, a film.
And this is a Prometheus story in many ways.
Yes. Oh, well, it's the subtitle, right?
Yeah.
The modern Prometheus. I, to answer your question quickly, and I know you're going to find this strange, I love Young Frankenstein. I think Mel Brooks really understands Mary Shelley. I mean, there's a parent who tries to take responsibility for his child, in for want of a better word. So I like that, and I really like Ex Machina. And now there I haven't seen it yet. I've seen the first Mary Shelley story, but now there's another Mary Shelley biography in theaters, and also the Genius series on TV is going to do. They've already done Picasso, and they've done Einstein. The third one they're going to do in the fall is Mary Shelley. So that'll be kind of interesting.
And it's more than interesting when you think about the fact that women were just not publishing contemporaneous Mm-mm. to Mary Shelley. I mean, you know, they were publishing under men's names like George Eliot or George Sand.
Well, she submitted it, as you know, Michael. She submitted it anonymously, and everyone thought Percy wrote it.
Yeah. Some comments. John writes, Shelley was the first novelist to deal with the inherent dangers of science. Ray Bradbury also comes to mind. The danger is that the human ability to invent technology outstrips our common sense, executive function, and moral compass. We are living in that dangerous world right now. And Chris writes, I wonder what Mary Shelley would say if she could come back and see the vast amount of works available to pour over today that sprang from her single story. IMDb gives me a list of 200 titles derivative of Frankenstein, including variants like Crankenstein. And that's only because it cuts off at 200. Then, of course, there are the books. In fact, there are more Google entries of Frankenstein than there are of Macbeth. I find that to be fascinating. But let me get to some more of your calls. And let's go next to Kay. Kay, join us.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
Hi, I wanted to touch a little bit on the idea that Mary Shelley was having an affair with Percy Shelley and became pregnant and then wrote a story about a man who creates a life and then rejects it.
What do you think, Ellen Peel? You want to go there for a moment?
Yeah, Mary Shelley had a very strange, complicated relationship both to birth and the ethics around that, and to the issue of being unconventional, I guess you would say. So both her parents were very unconventional. They welcomed, her mother died, and then her father welcomed Percy Shelley into his kind of salon, partly to borrow money from him. But anyway, Mary was quite surprised when her father was upset when Mary ran off with Percy, because she thought, oh, free love's supposed to be good. And then some people argue that after Percy died in, I think, 1822, Mary tried to kind of remake her life as being more of a proper Victorian lady. So I think she was extremely ambivalent. And some people see the novel as a tribute to the heroism of Promethean British romantics. Others see it as a feminist critique of, look what happens when we these narcissistic jerks get out of control. So there's a lot going on there.
There are 8 versions of the novel, though, right? Ellen, I believe there are 8 versions.
I don't know if there were 8 different editions. I know there was one between 1818 and 1831, but the first big changes were in 1831.
Let me bring up one other thing here, if I could, and let me go back to you on this, Sam Arbuthnot. Back in 1999, there was a big controversy, and it still goes on because of GMOs, about Frankenfood, and Tony Blair actually, he was prime minister then, called himself... we got dressed up like Frankenstein and brought a lot of attention
to
Frankenfood. Yeah, the creature, excuse
me. As the creature.
Yes. I mean, again, you have all these analogs and all these robotics and machine learning, and, you know, we've touched upon just a few of them with respect to technology. But particularly now with extending human life and with phenomena like GMOs and Frankenfood, I mean, they're too ubiquitous, I think, to name. So how to sort them out and really connect them to Frankenstein is really what I'm getting at here with my question to you.
That's a great question. I think I'm not sure I have a great answer for it, but I would say probably one of the best ways to kind of think about where everything lies is kind of on, and we mentioned kind of the scale of like humility to hubris, but also to see how big a change something is. Like if you're proceeding with sort of a iterative tinkering mindset where you say, okay, I'm going to change something a little bit, see how it responds and kind of go from there to really try to understand how each change actually affects the larger society and system that it's part of. Then I think that kind of when you're part of on that side of the equation, then I think it's better. If you're trying to kind of inject a very large change all at once, then you can end up with these huge amounts of unintended consequences. And I think actually, even within the novel, Victor at one point thinks about making something a little bit smaller and then decides, no, I'm going to build this kind of thing all at once. And it was this sort of phase transition, this really big jump. That was what ended up creating something that really he had no understanding of how to deal with. And I think oftentimes when we think about creation in biology or technology, we have to proceed with sort of this kind of iterative tinkering mindset, as opposed to saying, we're going to build something really, really big and inject it all at once and then kind of just see what happens. And I think that to do it, when you do that, then you're often abdicating a certain amount of responsibility. And then it's not nearly as good, and you end up with a lot of negative consequences.
Well, the thing I neglected to add was when Tony Blair dressed up and brought attention to Frankenfood, he had a sign on that he was going to get up a Frankenstein. Prime, instead of Prime Minister, said Prime Monster. and here's Breton, who writes, Frankenstein is a religious allegory. Man creates Frankenstein and he becomes monstrous. We hate him because he reminds us that God created man and he is monstrous. Ellen Peel?
Yeah, it's hard to tell if this book is a critique of God for creating humans or is God punishing humans for trying to rival him. Is it a critique of beings who create humans without a female partner, which is what God did and Victor did. So certainly it's very important to do a religious reading of this book. Paradise Lost is quoted on the title page. Adam is saying to God, basically, I didn't ask to be born. But as I say, it's hard to pin down where the values lie. And I think that's one reason the book has been fascinating for so many years.
It also fascinates me that Mary Shelley referred to this creature as my hideous progeny, just about prenatal or ready to give birth. I mean, you know, there's always that metaphor of authors giving birth to books and goes out and lives in the world and all that. Let me read a comment from Enrique, who says, my favorite Frankenstein versions are Philip K. Dick's Blade Runner and Minority Report. Mm-hmm. The man must have done time travel. Much of what Dick wrote about decades ago is becoming real. And one thinks in this context, Les Friedman, of films like, Blade Runner and, of course, Terminator.
Well, I think that's true, and Blade Runner is certainly one of my favorite films ever. The old one, not the new one necessarily, yeah. This is the sequel. But yes, Blade Runner is very, very Frankensteinian, and I would throw something else in the mix. I would throw Jurassic Park in there, since we're about to see a new Jurassic Park. And one of the things we haven't talked about, and it's spoken specifically in Jurassic Park, is that the flaw of the Dr. Frankenstein characters is they think they're in control of the situation. In fact, if you remember, Hammond, the Frankenstein character in Jurassic Park, starts talking about how he's going to rebuild the park and says, well, this time I'll be, you know, I'll control it this way, this way. And the Laura Dern character, I forget her name, says, no, that's the illusion that you're in control. You're not in control once you create it.
Let me read some more listener comments. Here's Darren, who writes, some appreciate the question, what if we are Frankenstein? But they miss the more poignant question, what if we are the monster? This speaks to the human condition. And Frank writes, it's a little, more of footnote nature, but he says, my email address is Frankencrank, because I invented some bicycle cranks that are really strange. I just thought I would throw that in. Thanks, Frank. We always
you
enjoy
have
those
very
kinds of
literate
things
listeners,
in.
Michael.
Don't I? I take great pride
yeah,
in that.
My goodness, so, these are such interesting comments.
Yeah. I'm spoiled that way. We all are
you
here
are.
On the Forum program. But let's go back to some of these films that have been made, because there are so many of them. There was even we were talking about Frankenstein not having a female mate, but there was a film, Les, I know you probably know, Lady Frankenstein.
Well, there was also a film called The Bride with, of all
yeah,
things,
The Bride of
Sting.
Frankenstein, right.
Well, you're talking about...
Well, I'm talking about Frankenstein turned into gender fluidity or whatever in movies.
Right. Well, of course, there is the 1935 film, The Bride of Frankenstein, which is, I think, the best of the Universal films. But later on, there is Sting as Dr. Frankenstein in The Bride. There are a few versions where Dr. Frankenstein becomes a woman. But I think, as Ellen said earlier, it's quite rare. There are more versions, including Penny Dreadful, which was a wonderful TV series that included a Frankenstein what included Dr. Frankenstein. It wasn't a character, it was Dr. Frankenstein, in which the creature becomes a woman. And then, of course, not only is there the whole antagonism, but inevitably the creator now falls in love with the creature.
Okay,
and then has to deal with those feelings.
I just want to read a final question here because we're running short on time. Rick wants to know, he says, I've never read Frankenstein. Does it still hold up as a book? And any edition recommendation? Let me go to each of you on this. Let's start with you, Ellen Peel.
Well, I tend to assign my students something affordable, so the Signet edition is affordable. If you want a scholarly edition, Johanna M. Smith's Bedford St. Martin's edition has wonderful essays and further information.
And it still holds up in your judgment, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And to you, Sam Obersman?
I think it definitely still holds up. And actually, in terms of an edition, there was actually one that just recently came out. I think it's geared towards scientists and engineers. And it's like this annotated edition all about kind of the scientific and engineering kind of thoughts on that.
And Les Friedman?
The Norton Critical Edition that James Hunter edited, which has a lot of good essays in it about it, too.
Thank you all. Thanks to Lester Friedman, to Sam Arbisman, and to Ellen Peel, and also to Audrey Schaefer. And thanks to you, our listeners. And as long as I'm giving bountiful thanks, let me remind you, KQED Forum is produced by Tina Larberg, Susan Britton, and Christina Kim. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer is Steve Ostrogatto. And our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. And we get online support from Amanda Font. Interns are Lisa Brotman and Alessandra Wolner, Eli Cohen. Managing editor is Ethan Lindsay. And our executive producer is Holly Kernan. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.